We welcome to the program our friend, writer Colin Fleming. His latest book, If You Brackets, Fabula, Fantasy, Effery, Hope, available everywhere. Colin, welcome back, and glad to hear that you have not unexpectedly thrashed whatever illness was wreaking havoc last week.
No, I still got something lingering, Kimball. I am mired in mucus, the mucus situation. Yeah. Now I am pretty well clogged in the lungs and the, when I put my hand over my ear, have you ever had this? A sound comes out of my head.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
That's weird, right?
When you get to be my age, it happens a lot.
Does it really?
Oh, yeah.
The first time I noticed this and freaked me out a little bit. It was, I was worried at first. It was my essence leaving me. I thought, oh, no, everything's gone. Bad enough as it is. But what am I going to do post-essence? I thought, I don't know. Maybe it's like I can blend in better. I'll be more regular and, like, I can be mediocre. But no, I need my essence. I'll give you a perspective. I only ran 1,000 stairs today because I was doing so hot.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that. I thought by now you would have put this thing in its place. This is a tough bug you've gotten a hold of.
I think I might have had a combo of the COVID and then some kind of allergy thing.
Ugh.
Pollen, maybe. I don't know. I just, I'm not in pain anymore. I'm just mired in that mucus. I keep seeing, you know, that little like green dude?
That guy.
Yeah, he's like, I'm the mucus monster. I keep like, oh no, you're haunting my vision, mucus monster.
See, I would sick Hermie on the mucus guy.
Yeah. You know what? Sometimes like my ears pop too. And I think I'm hearing normally, but I'm really like, I'm under like this blanket of depressed audio. And then suddenly I get like this moment of clarity and I can hear the world again. But power through, Kimball. I write so much and so much like goes down that way that I feel really ashamed as I'm saying all of this to you, because last week sounds to me, for me, feels like forever ago. And now I'm thinking I'm a sickly little bitch, and that is not part of the Zulu code of conduct, as you know.
Yeah, but you're a trooper. No matter what ails you, you are here giving your all to elevate the program, and so we appreciate that. As always, Colin Fleming with us here on Downtown. We're going to talk about F. Scott Fitzgerald this week, and I guess we have to begin with The Great Gatsby. Is it, from your perspective, the great American novel?
No! It doesn't say Fleming on the front, Kimball. you like that. It's true, but I made it into a joke. No, I would say that it is, I think of it more as a long, short story than I do anything else. And I think Gatsby is, in some ways, a curse for the legacy of F. Scott Fitzgerald, because you see all of these people in life, certainly on dating sites, when they're asked what their favorite book is, there are only like 3 or 4 they ever mention. And so if they say The Great Gatsby, you completely, as this guy I used to know who'd say, it's like you're blowing up my spot, you completely blow up their spot if you say, oh, what else did you like by him?
Nothing, I haven't read anything else by him.
Well, if you loved it so much, it doesn't make a lot of sense that you just stop there, would it? So you didn't even really, like, love it. You might have read it too early in life to love it, but it was the one thing that you actually finished, which is incredibly depressing. And it's additionally depressing because F. Scott Fitzgerald wrote so much. And he died in his, 44? So didn't make it that far. But near the end of his life, he was talking about how he had written 130 stories, and how he gave everything of himself, and more than himself. He said it wasn't just his blood and his sweat and his seed even, it was the extra that he had. And then he repeated the number of 130 stories again. He would just sit in this room over the garage, and he'd crank them. He would just do like, all right, I'm doing 3,000 words tonight, and he'd have at it. So Gatsby is a misleading book because of the notoriety it's had in the decades.
Yeah, and why has it had those legs? Why, I know, I was reading, I did not know this, that they handed out copies to soldiers during World War II. That certainly made it more popular, but it's still on reading lists. Schools still teach it. What has enabled it to become his best-known work?
It's a Citizen Kane, in a way, of novels, the books, because it wasn't like it was some massive hit. Do you know what I'm saying?
Right.
Like, Citizen Kane wasn't some massive hit. Part of it's going to be the length. Great Gatsby is 40,000 words long. So that's going to make it perfect for high school. Now, we've talked so often about length, and I wrote a preface to a book today that deals in length. 40,000 words of F. Scott Fitzgerald is not going to be, you know what I mean? Like, there's a translator. There's, like, a conversion, like when you take the money into Canada type of thing, for the words, 40,000 F. Scott Fitzgerald words are someone else's 4 million words. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and so, you talked about that in the blog today, that how people often, if they have to guess how many words in a piece of yours, they're often under for any number of reasons. They don't seem long.
They're never close, even a smart guy like you. Like, I remember when we were talking a while ago about De Silva, and they can get it wrong both ways. And my point with that is that we don't measure experiences, life experiences, the richest life experiences, in terms of, like, the clock or the word count. That's not how that works, because we're absorbed into the experience. And it's like that cliche. It's like, oh, I had so much fun, I didn't know how much time had passed. There's an element of that with the best art. So I throw all that out, like word count. What does that even mean when you're talking about someone like an F. Scott Fitzgerald? But the idea that he only had so many novels, and where are you going to go with those novels? This Side of Paradise, it's mangy. It's overgrown. It tries to be all these different things at once. It's very much an apprentice work. The Beautiful and Damned is kind of a downer. He's still not sure what he's going to be yet. Tender is the Night probably has better prose than The Great Gatsby, but it doesn't have the rollicking flavor of the jazz era, which has certainly helped this novel over the years. And also, it's just that Fitzgerald, who, someone like his, he worshipped Hemingway. One of Fitzgerald's blind spots is a man. He was a really good man, but he had these blind spots. He was prone to hero worship. So he would hero worship a guy like Hemingway, and Fitzgerald could write circles around him. Hemingway's prose hasn't aged well, because it's just tied into that gimmick. It's like, okay, we get it. You kind of imitate the Bible, and you don't use a lot of commas. Got it. When you read Fitzgerald's prose, like in some of these stories or in The Great Gatsby, even more so in the stories, it is so fresh and it's so modern. And even when he has a 50-word sentence, he's writing downhill and you're going along with it without the work. As a prose stylist, he's just better than, like, you only have a few people on this hand. You have Flaubert, you have Fitzgerald, you have Proust, and there's not going to be a lot of other people there. So I think that's another reason, too. You're getting great art, but it's not terribly difficult to read and comprehend.
There is a new Library of America edition of Fitzgerald's work, and you especially want to draw people who haven't read it to Winter Dreams. I wasn't sure what to make of Dexter Green early on, but he becomes a very interesting and compelling character as the story goes on, and this odd relationship and I guess undying love for the fair Judy.
Odd relationship. You sound like a man who's got enough easy on love in life, Kimball. You've avoided some heartbreaks. I'm happy for you.
We've all had our share. Come on now.
Yeah, but you haven't. It sounds like you haven't had that person who. Now, this Library of America edition, it's great. It's the second in this series, and it includes The Great Gatsby. It's a restored text, and it has this novel, All the Sad Young Men, from. So it's Fitzgerald in, like, the early 1920s for the most part. Winter Dreams is, I believe, one of the greatest works of art an American has ever made. I think it's Fitzgerald's best fiction of any kind. I think it's a technically perfect story. And the reason I was teasing you there is because it's about this guy who has a lot of pride, and some of his plot points in life follow Fitzgerald. But Fitzgerald never really did autobiography. Even when he would tell other people to, he's like, you're the basis for my story. Only a couple girls will notice it. Don't worry about it. It's fine. He still would. The imagination doesn't stop. The imagination is still going to have the say. Fitzgerald, like, you, I can sit down to write something and I think it's something that happened to me. But when it's done, it's not something that happened to me, save that I've experienced through the actual writing whatever that story is. It wasn't like, oh, I took this from my life. It always becomes so far afield of that. So it's about this guy, his pride, and he's like working. He's a caddy and all this stuff, and he doesn't want to see this girl that he likes to know that he has to work for other people. And the way that this all shakes out is he thinks he's in good with this girl. He really, like, this is the girl of his dreams, and he finds out he's one of, like, 18 beaux, like, would-be suitors for her, and she finally goes off to, like, Florida, and he marries this woman that's described as, like, kind of physically plain. You get that a lot back then, and I thought, huh, is that so good? But then when you look at a dating site, people are like, what I'm looking for? It's like, tall guy, like, strong chin. No one even talks about, like, I mean, you could be a molester. They don't even get into that. It's just all about how you look. So it made me feel better about this. And so he's now, it's going to work out. He's got his new girl. Then the one he loves comes back. And like so many people there have ever been, he's like, see you, Plain Jane. I love you again. And he wants this woman. And it just, it doesn't work. I mean, now as I'm saying this a lot, I'm thinking like, yep, been there. And the story is still not even done. He's going to go off to the war. He's going to end up successful, and he's going to be in New York, and he's going to hear a report about this individual. Mm. And that's the type of thing that Fitzgerald does so well, because that is a story. The report is a story unto itself. And it doesn't really work out in a way for anyone. I mean, it's such a wise story, and he was such a young man.
And that's the moment when he hears that story. That's the moment when I finally felt some empathy for Dexter and thought, oh, yeah, all right, now I know. Because, yeah, we've all been in a situation similar to that. But, I didn't feel he deserved what happened to him.
You know, and I know a lot of people, Kimball, who, almost everyone I know, who have gotten exactly what they wanted from life. And they're unhappy because what they wanted ended up not being enough. Or I should say what they went for. And if you look at this life on paper of this guy, in some ways it's gone well for like a lot of it. And he's hung up on this person who, well, frankly, wasn't worth it, right? I mean, she just isn't. It's not like misogyny or anything like that. We get hung up on people who just aren't worth it. We get hung up on comments that we shouldn't get hung up on. And sometimes that speaks to a lack of anything else in our lives. So we fixate on them more. But when he gets the report about her and she's like kind of lost her looks and her husband isn't spectacularly warm to her, he's heartbroken again in a way that I don't think he anticipates being heartbroken at that point. I think he thinks that he sort of washed his hands, the mixed metaphor for us of this particular heartbreak. But he's made this decision to have this diffuse his being, this person. He's has a culpability in this bittersweet end of this for this relationship that never was with this person he'll probably never see again. I think it's just so real. It can be real. It's happening out there right now. It's happening to different people in my building to different degrees as we speak. It's just the nature of life. And that's why this story is what it is. And if you look at like the last paragraph, it's a kind of music. It's not music. It's not poetry. It's almost like anticipates beat poetry in a way. It anticipates rhythm and blues. If you read it aloud, that sort of stutter step back and forth, sprung rhythm of it. He just was a master prose writer, a prose poet.
How does Anson Hunter in The Rich Boy differ from Dexter Green?
Well, Fitzgerald certainly has a preoccupation with wealth and class, and people will know this story without knowing it. It's like an air supply song that way, I guess. Like, who's air supply? It's like, even the night side. Like, yeah, let's do it. So with this story, people know that line. They misused the line. You know the line I mean. The rich are very different.
Very different from you and me. Yes, indeed.
Yeah, and Hemingway, who was just a bad guy, decided to be a dick about this. He's like, yeah, they have more money. It's like, you simpleton. Do you think that's what he's saying? I mean, you really think that that's what he's going for? You have to understand what a terrible person Hemingway was, too. He, like, Fitzgerald was so insecure at times that, like, he thought Zelda had told him that his manhood was smaller than it ought to be. So he had Hemingway check it out. And he's not, Hemingway's not the guy you want to ask about that, because he's not going to let you forget. And also, when Fitzgerald would write these confessional essays, Hemingway would always say that he was weak. He was not manly enough. I mean, as like just that machismo. People who are as manly as you can be are the people who have no problem letting you know what they're going through or how they feel. Not for attention, but because that's what they're going through. So that line about the rich being different from you and me, he was talking about like the way I would talk about like a David Remnick on the blog. Just a horrible, horrible person who is insecure and lets power corrupt. There's very few people who have the moral character not to be corrupted by power. It's like one out of like a million. I was reading this story today about Bobby Orr, and he had this teammate, not even a teammate, he was a trainer. You know about this?
No.
Trainer on the Bruins, and he was an alcoholic, and he couldn't keep a job, and like his family sort of disowned him, and he had nowhere to stay, and Bobby Orr took him in. And right after the guy was taken into Orr's home, and so they're both like around 50, the guy had brain cancer, so he was going to die. So Orr cared for the guy with his wife for like the last year of the guy's life. He lived with him and everything. I had no idea about the story. And I just thought, wow, there is like with every bit of attention that guy has, that he's maintained that level of humanness. So I think this is a story about that push and pull. Because Fitzgerald believed that the money was going to take people who might have been neutral and turn them into bad people, and really the saving grace of life. And I believe this. I could have $1 trillion and I'd believe this. Is work. How hard you work at what you do, at what's important to you. For Fitzgerald, for me, that's writing. But I think this is a story really about those themes.
And so many of Fitzgerald's characters seem to be people who believe that their wealth, however they came into it, gives them a level of superiority.
How many people is that then? And now, maybe more so now, because you can broadcast your wealth with social media. And like I was reading this story about this guy who was like sold his rehab company. He would help get people off heroin for 9 figures. And on his Instagram and on his Twitter, it was just photos of his Lamborghinis and his mansions. And there he is with some rapper or whatever it was. And he was in the news because, surprise, surprise, he was like trying to rape and molest and coerce like all of these people who would come to his clinic. Like, really no shock there. And it's like he thought he was above everything because he had these photos of these things that ultimately are soulless and they don't matter. Like, I feel like it's one thing to have a home full of books and the books can be worth a lot of money, but you take the books down from the shelf and it's thorough, and it enriches your life, and it adds something that's art to your being, but just for show, not for utility. So that's what a lot of Fitzgerald's characters, like you said, they're trying to deal in that, because that seems easier to deal in than the reality of who we are. Like that idea that like these thieves, and you always see it like in film noirs, they invest so much time and energy into like being criminals. And you wonder, like, if they just kind of repurposed that, maybe things would, they'd have, like, their own bar, and they'd have their friends come by, and they'd have a nice little family business and pass it on to the son. But no, they want to do these things that just are hollow, and they're not going to take you anywhere. And Fitzgerald's always aware of that, even when he has lots of money, which he burned through, because he's still about these fundamental qualities. Like, when I say that he's a good person, I'm saying because he never veered from those qualities, and he never veered from them in his writing.
Fitzgerald seems to value I guess, an honesty, perhaps, maybe an innocence that comes with people from the Midwest, particularly Minnesota, but it seems to be a different relationship to Tennessee in the sensible thing, the home of Jonquil, which just comes across as a really drab and boring place to be.
It does, and Fitzgerald has this strange kind of history with the South, because we don't really think of Fitzgerald in the South. We think of him really Midwesterner, like you said. We think of wealth in the Northeast and New York and all of that, and we think of the French Riviera. Those are kind of like the, and I guess in Hollywood too, right? The end of his life, and he's going to be a screenwriter, and that's where all those guys went. Like William Faulkner, he went out to Hollywood to write screenplays, which is really strange when you think about it, isn't it? That Faulkner is like, we need Faulkner on the new Marvel movie. Like, not really the guy. If he's like, Absalom, Absalom. You wouldn't think that would go so well, but it was just because you happened to do this job and you had this recognition at the job that you could go get this other better paying job. I mean, I say better paying. Fitzgerald was making like what's now like $100,000 a short story at the time. He was just burning through all of it. So this story, whenever we have that phrase, the sensible thing, don't you find in life, whenever someone does the sensible thing, it's usually bad, or it's going to be depressing.
Yes.
Or it's going to be not the thing you want to do, or it's like, really, do we have to? Because it's like, I don't know, the sensible thing would be to give up the child for adoption. Jump cut to 6 months later, there's the mother pining for the child she gets. You know what I mean? It's like, it's that. So this line, this story concludes too with a great little sequence where Fitzgerald could strike the aphorism, and it's one thing to be able to strike the aphorism, but you want to be able to strike the aphorism in such a way that no one really thinks you're striking the aphorism, just kind of like talking or going along in a story or in life or in conversation dialogue. And there is that line: there are all kinds of love in the world, but never the same love twice. Which I think you said you had tattooed on a buttock. Maybe?
Nearby. More on the hip, but yes.
Okay. A wrap around. That's,
I have a delicate frame, so it takes a lot of space there. Finally, I enjoyed revisiting something I'd read many, many years ago. A very, very funny piece, a great piece from Fitzgerald. How to Live on practically Nothing a Year, Visiting the French Riviera, apparently costly at any time.
I have to ask you, what caused you to read this? Were you just reading this for life back in the day?
Yeah, I think someone had recommended, back in my 20s, I think, I had read it. And I liked it then, but it meant a lot more to me now, with a few more years on the clock.
I had a girlfriend once who broke up with me because I had a journal that I called my journal for life. It was like a notebook, my notebook for life. I had a series of them. I still do. And she said to me, I don't want to be with someone who has a notebook for life. So that's why I had to ask. But it's one of those Fitzgerald essays. And I could see how you would like it, because it has an element of Woodhouse, has an element of Mr. Blandings Builds His Dream House, right?
Yeah.
Has an element of the Thin Man, the banter, the wit. And that was the thing about Fitzgerald. I'm not saying that he was like Buster Keaton of prose. Actually, you know what he was? Because a lot of times Buster Keaton was very witty, but he wasn't like a guffaw guy. And Fitzgerald is highly witty. He's very amusing. There can be real humor in his autobiographical pieces and in his stories. Like, how about that bit in Winter Dreams when the guy quits the job and he's like so happy to be out of there? And he, like, his boss, his former boss now, he's like magnanimously thanking his former boss for telling him to screw, because he wouldn't have been able to do it otherwise. And he's like, you owe me for 3 weeks' pay, but you can keep it. And he's liberated. It's like, it reads like something out of like a smart modern sitcom. You could put it in Frasier, I guess. So this is an answer piece to How to Live on $36,000 a Year, which doesn't sound like anything now, but at the time it was like $9 million. And there's actually not a lot about finance in this. It's more about living by your wit and talking your way through things, and a romanticized back and forth between Scott and Zelda and the baby and Nanny, and they're dashing hither and yon. It's rollicking, and it's good, and it's witty, and I think it's something that people don't really expect with Fitzgerald, especially because they simply just read Gatsby if they read anything.
Yeah, and I feel like to a number of people, Gatsby is a creature of another time, but this is an example of how relevant he still is. Why should people read him today?
The reason, like with Gatsby being pegged to a time, though, I really feel like that's the popularity of like flapper fashion.
Mm.
It's never really gone away. We have parties like that out at your like Bangor manse, right? Like a lawn party with Kimball, and everyone wears their 1920s garb. So I think that's just a period of American history that's romanticized. But that doesn't mean that that story is of the 1920s. You know what I'm saying? It's like Orson Welles was talking to Peter Bogdanovich about the difference between Booth Tarkington's humor and Mark Twain's humor. Now, Booth Tarkington wrote two novels, Penrod and 17, that Fitzgerald thought were just the funniest things he'd ever read. I mean, they're hilarious. And they were sort of like targets I had in mind when I was doing Meatheads. I'm like, I want to surpass these. But Bogdanovich was like, well, why isn't Tarkington around like the way Twain is? And Welles said, because Twain did this sort of out-of-the-country kind of prelapsarian, Edenic, mangy, wild like humor. It's not like tied to a date. So when we come to the end of Gatsby, we think of the green fields of the Republic rolling on under the night. It's not like the pastures of the Midwest of the United States. The green fields of the Republic. It takes it out of the 1920s. And when I read Fitzgerald and when I read this essay, any of these things, it never reads like I'm in 1925. I think that's surprising to people if they would go and read it, because they have this expectation that it's going to be antiquated, all this stuff. You could trick somebody into believing that was written now, allowing that there were actually people who wrote well now. But the language wouldn't be like, oh, I need a translator. It's not like reading Chaucer or Shakespeare or anything like that. It's startlingly modern. And Hemingway wasn't that way. Fitzgerald was that way. His dialogue works. It's crisp. It's believable. The rhythms are natural. People just have, like, very few, but some people just have an ear for how they should arrange the word. It's a beat. It's a syllable. It's rhythm. It's all of that. He had that. So that's reason enough to read it. And also, he's one of the smartest people who's ever lived, and he's one of, like, the 6, 8, 10 best writers there's ever been. So don't stop with Gatsby. Don't even start there, but get into all this other stuff. It really makes him as special as he is.
Absolutely. Colin Fleming with us on Downtown. Thank you, as always, my friend. Take that mucus monster and just crush him, beat him down in these next few days.
Okay, I'll work on it.
All right. Thanks, Colin.